Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's launch into some emails. This from Sybil in SoCal, and Sybil writes, "Dear Dr. Dawn, we wondered why certain people experience side effects and some don't. Both my husband and I and some of our friends around mid-60s had some body aches, enough to take the day off. A few had a fever," and this is presumably after the COVID vaccine. And when I asked around, I found that a 99-year-old and a 78-year-old, as well as a couple of other people in their mid-70s, had no side effects whatsoever. Someone explained that older people's immune systems are weaker. But does that mean the vaccine was less effective in those people who had no side effects? It looks like all of the 20-somethings experienced acute side effects of some kind as well. An immunologist from UCSF was asked that question of why certain people experience side effects and others don't. He didn't really answer the question. He only mentioned that those people with side effects have their immune systems doing push-ups. But that didn't really answer the question. What's your take on it? Well, first of all, Sybil, even though you have a circle of friends, the actual number of people is too small to draw anything more than anecdotal conclusions from. And I haven't seen a lot of published data looking at side effects or reactions by age, although I'm pretty sure that we'll be seeing a paper sometime. But something like that, you'd want peer-reviewed, you'd want someone taking a look at the math, and stuff like that's kind of getting back-burnered because we don't necessarily want to discourage people because of side effects. You shouldn't be afraid of these side effects. And I agree with the immunologist that in general, when you get a reaction after a vaccination, it means that the vaccination is going to take. But the converse is not necessarily true. So younger people do have stronger immune systems. I mean, think about a child, okay? You've got a three-year-old. Three-year-old is going to run a fever of like 103, 104, huge fevers. They're going to be really inflamed from an infection, but they're also going to do a really good job at fighting it off. And as we get older, we develop what's called kind of a break, right? The inflammation's the accelerator. We develop a better break. Our immune system gets better at kind of controlling itself and not having a tantrum and not shutting itself and is able to sort of, yeah, just kind of coast to a stop. It's fine. You've got enough inflammation. Now let's chill. And we hold on to that until, in women, it's pretty abrupt. Around menopause, we lose our estrogen levels. And estrogen is a really strong immune modulating thing. So women tend to notice more aches and pains, kind of everything that used to hurt starts hurting again. And that's part of the menopausal transition. And then the system says, oh, wait, I need to come up with some other anti-inflammatory signals because estrogen's no longer there doing it for me. And you kind of adjust. But as we age, a couple of things happen. And one of them is that for a long time, like during the 60s and early 70s, you become more inflamed. And then there's this point where you've still got your break, but the immune system just isn't able to mount as strong reaction to a vaccine. It's old. It's tired. It doesn't, you know, run the marathon quite as quickly anymore. And in that situation, which is not strictly speaking age related, it's more aging related. And, you know, there are young 65-year-olds and old 65-year-olds. But in the people who are older, and I mean, not necessarily chronologically, but physiologically, you want to use a stronger vaccine. So, for example, we have the extra strength flu vaccine, and we have that Shingrix vaccine, which, in my opinion, if you're 50 and you take that, you want to count on some side effects with the booster because it's made to be strong. Because what we're trying to do is prevent shingles in 78-year-olds and 85-year-olds. So it has to be very strong and really wave a red flag at the bull in order to get us what we need. When we had our 1918 flu, one of the things that was very specific about that flu was who died. There was a big bump in younger people from that particular flu. And that was because the immune system really was too strong and it overreacted, and you got an almost Ebola-like syndrome from those individuals. And of course, every virus has its own personality, even when you're within a specific family of viruses like the influenza viruses. But as a general rule with the flu, if your immune system has seen it before, it's better at just fighting it off and being proportionate in its response. And if it's a novel one and you're young and your immune system has not seen it before, you get the carpet bombing effect. You know, we had to destroy the village in order to save it, which is not good. So I think another thing that we have to take a look at, and I'm just going to talk about this briefly, is that the COVID-19 vaccines, the SARS-CoV-2 of Moderna and Pfizer, are really a different animal. They're nanolipid balls with a compound called PEG, polyethylene glycol. Now, if you go to the pharmacy and you look for polyethylene glycol, you'll find it actually for sale as a laxative, because it works as a laxative. And of course, it's also used in a lot of common foods. It's used in ice cream. It's used in a bunch of different things. When they were thinking about safety here, they were focusing on anaphylactic reactions. When I was still volunteering at the vaccine clinics, you screened people, are you allergic to polyethylene glycol? And most people would say, I have no idea. And you'd say, well, can you eat ice cream? And if they can eat ice cream and they're using standard shampoos and household cleaning products, they're being exposed. And if they aren't getting hot, wheezing or sneezing or hives, then they're not allergic. But people can form other antibodies. And those of you who are regular listeners will know I'm often talking about the IgG antibodies and how people can have IgG against food. For example, you can have IgG against gluten. You can have IgG against chicken. I have that. Really cramps your style when you eat out, I might add. But anyway, when you have high levels of IgG against a food, you don't get wheezing or sneezing or hives or anaphylaxis. You get body aches. You get joint pain. You get blah. And it lasts for a few days and then dissipates. So I'm not entirely sure that some of this vaccine reaction that we're seeing in the young people and the older people might not be in some way mediated by antibodies against this polyethylene glycol or PEG-elated, they're called, products. It's a stabilizing agent and it's used widely. But there is a rare syndrome called complement activation-related pseudoallergy. And in this case, those antibodies think that the PEG-elated compound is a virus and you can get some really strong anaphylactoid reactions. They're not anaphylaxis because they're not, by definition, mediated by IgE, but they sure look a lot like it. And this has happened several times with drug trials. There was a experimental anticoagulant containing PEG-elated RNA that lost out in its phase 3 trial, and they had 16,000 people, and 0.6% of them had a really bad reaction. Then they went back and they looked and they found, wait, these people have high levels of anti-polyethylene glycol, IgG. So we have an established thing. It's new. It's novel vaccine. Maybe this is part of that reaction. Maybe it's just the stimulation of the immune system. At this point, we really don't know. But the most important thing that I want to say about this is we've got a serious issue with the COVID-19, and we have a very, very small issue with weird reactions in a tiny fraction of the population to the vaccine. And we need to not set our hair on fire. We need to keep our shirts on. We need to think about risk benefit, and the risk is small. I heard it described as, you know, you talk about, oh, well, your chances of this happening to you are like your chances of being struck by lightning, or it's like the chances of being eaten by a shark. Well, I love this one. They said the chances of having a really severe adverse reaction to these vaccines is about the same odds as being struck by lightning while being eaten by a shark. So just to put it in perspective, 10,000 times greater than the risk you took to drive to work this morning. And so let's all take a deep breath, because you don't even think about, oh, I might die today when I drive to work. Sometimes while you're driving, you think that, but usually not before you pack out of the driveway. Let's go to our next email. This one from Elizabeth in Pacific Grove, California. Dear Dr. Don, I have been a weekly podcast listener for many years, but didn't think to ask you about my iron issue until a friend suggested it. I'm a 65-year-old Caucasian female in good health. I eat a plant-based, low-fat diet, walk 5 miles a day, and I have type 1 diabetes, which is well managed. 2 years ago, I tried to donate blood, and I was turned away for low red blood cell count. Due to COVID, I didn't follow up with it until earlier this year. Lab results showed a total iron of 23, which is low, and a hematocrit of 33.2%, which is anemic, mild anemic. I was put on ferrous sulfate, 325 milligrams, for 6 weeks, retested, and the hematocrit had not budged. It was exactly the same, and the iron actually decreased to 21%. My doctor has now doubled the iron and referred me to my GI doctor with a colonoscopy likely. I'm 6 years into my 10-year cycle on that. A possibility of a cancer in the GI tract has been mentioned, so I'm concerned. I don't have any symptoms. Any thoughts from a functional medicine perspective? Well, let's start with the stomach. So one of the things that could be happening, and you need to look at whether you're using naproxen or ibuprofen or aspirin. A lot of people might at 65 might be taking a baby aspirin for cardiovascular health, which, by the way, in women is probably a bad idea. But getting back to your situation, that can cause GI tract blood loss. And so it's possible that it's a benign source like that. The fact that you aren't absorbing the iron is interesting. And again, we're going to start at the stomach and say, maybe you have low stomach acid, because iron relies on stomach acid to dissociate. So you're taking ferrous sulfate, which is a salt. Now, if I take salt, sodium chloride, and I put it on the table, and it will sit there, it's not going to automatically dissociate. It needs moisture and effectively water to pull the salt apart, right? So in the case of your stomach with ferrous sulfate, you actually need a low pH or acidic environment. And if you aren't able to generate that, that can be a factor. Now, here's where the diabetes comes in. Type 1 diabetics are especially prone to something called autonomic neuropathy. You've heard of peripheral neuropathy. That's where your feet go numb and tingle and burn. Autonomic neuropathy is silent, but the nerve to the stomach simply doesn't kick up the acid. So people with autonomic neuropathy will sometimes feel very full after eating. Sometimes they will get what's called gastroparesis, which is essentially the food does not leave the stomach. It just sits there and the stomach keeps churning, and they maybe even end up vomiting after an hour or so. But more typically, they get problems with just the normal functioning of the absorptive surfaces, because you're not secreting the right digestive fluids, including stomach acid, and that could be a factor. So what's your fix? Well, while you're waiting, and I do believe you got to get checked out for the cancer. I mean, yeah, 6 years, it could have happened. You certainly don't want to miss that, but get yourself some Arceola vitamin C. That's the rose hips vitamin C, not the synthetic stuff, the rose hips vitamin C, and take, you know, a decent dose, 500 milligrams every time you take the iron. The Arceola vitamin C will improve absorption of iron. So if your problem is absorption, that should allow that iron level to start coming up. The reason your doctors are worried is because you could be leaking blood and therefore leaking iron, and the supplement just isn't keeping up with it. You probably also should get occult blood testing, and presumably they've done that, but your stool needs to be checked on several occasions to see whether or not it's positive for blood. I don't know when your colonoscopy is scheduled, but that would be helpful for you just to figure out whether there's a problem. We're going to be back with our next email, but just to close out, I wanted to solicit kind of an email. I found a wonderful website that basically lists all of the ingredients in all of the vaccines. And it's sort of interesting, but it doesn't list Moderna or Janssen or AstraZeneca, because those are not approved vaccines. So that was kind of disappointing. I found this incidentally, but I'm going to carry it around and have it around, because I think people are always wondering about the safety of vaccines. I personally don't have a problem. If there's a vaccine for it, I want it. But that's because of, well, among other things, I understand the math. But the math can be not terribly persuasive if you haven't had a scientific background. We're getting an email from Jacqueline in Santa Cruz, and Jacqueline's subject is turf burn. Hi, Dr. Don. Have you heard of a similar to turf burn sensation around the kneecap and sometimes on the shin? There's no abrasion visible, nor has it happened to be anything to the skin. So nerve pain, very rare that it happens, but when it does, it's there for many days on and off. Well, Jacqueline, that's sort of one of those medical mystery problems that people make the appointment for, and then by the time they come in, they don't have it anymore. And I'm like putting on my getting out my magnifying glass and my deer stalker hat, like Basil Rathbone in the old Sherlock Holmes, and or maybe Inspector Gadget, and trying to sort it out. So let's start with, we want to categorize it by age and activity and exposures. So since I don't know your age, activity, or exposures, I'm going to kind of do a general crawl through this. One of the things that does cross my mind is that this could be a masked low-grade shingles, like shingles trying to happen, but never turning into a rash. And I've definitely seen that sort of like skipping a stone across a Sillwater pond, a few viruses, irritation of the nerve, and then it drops down. Don't know if that's it, but it would be interesting to know about whether you've had your shingles vaccine. Secondly, you said it feels like nerve pain, but it's burny. And I think that's why you're saying it feels like nerve pain, because all the turf burns I've had have been burny. So you want to pay very close attention to when it starts. What have you been doing? What has been your physical position? Have you been bending? Have you been squatting? I had a patient call me today with a similar pain on his anterior thigh. And the first question I had out of my mouth was, okay, have you been carrying around boxes and holding them against your hip bones? Because when you do that, you can crush the nerve, and that will definitely, definitely give you that kind of a on again, off again thing. You can look it up on, if you want to. It's called Meralgia Paraesthetica, Meralgia Paraesthetica. And that is from pushing on the nerve, and the nerve is talking to you, and that can last for several days. You said many days. It typically will last for 4. So that could be a thing. And if you're pregnant, you're going to have it all the time, and we get the belly band for that. Another thing I would think about is, what's your B12? What's your folic acid? Are you deficient in these vitamins? Because that can cause the nerves to be irritable. Magnesium, usually it's muscles, but B12 and folate, it can irritate the nerves. And the other thing is, because it's at your kneecap, I would ask you, is when you have it, is it worse going downstairs? Because it's in the right place for the patella to be sore, and sometimes that'll radiate down to the front of the leg. So lots to think about, and unfortunately, I can't really give you an answer. And let's see, we have a caller on the line with a question about medical dental services in Mexico. Let's take that caller and have a chat.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. This is Dr. Don. What's your name?
This is David, and you pretty much already heard most of the question. I am curious. I know it's not your bailiwick exactly, but I'm curious, what is your opinion and or advice on someone seriously considering going to Mexico for dental work?
Well, it's broadly called medical tourism for a reason.
Yes.
Because, and it is, I think, an extremely legitimate thing to do, but it varies from country to country. So I would not go down to, I wouldn't go to Eastern Europe and get my dental work done.
I was talking specifically
Mexico,
right near the border.
Near the border, there is a huge business of Americans going south to get their dental work done. The dentists are very happy, and they rely on maintaining their good reputation in the age of the internet. That's very, very clear. Now, there are a lot of websites, and particularly those that cater to people who are the nomad land type people, and they go down and they camp out down in Arizona near the border and come down at, I guess, in the winter. and went between jobs, and they go across the border and they get their dental work done, and some of them maybe even get their joint replacements. I remember this would have been at least a decade ago, but I was traveling down in Merida, which is in the Yucatan. I was there for a couple of weeks for a language intensive. And while I was there, I, you know, talked to the people who ran this language school, and I said, I'm a doctor. I'd like to, you know, visit some hospitals and learn about the healthcare system, which I try to do wherever I travel. And they're like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, my sister-in-law's husband or whatever, you know. And so I got hooked up with a couple of doctors, and I went to their facilities, and one was a medical tourism, and they were very proud of it. You know, they wanted me to walk around. They were showing off, you know, their machines and their state-of-the-art stuff. And it was. It was pretty state-of-the-art. And they were doing, you know, a lot of cosmetics stuff, but they were also doing, they were doing orthopedic things and some joint replacements. I don't know if I'd get a joint replacement without really, really vetting the place, which is hard for a layperson to do, but teeth? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I thank you for your input.
You're welcome.
And have a good evening, and thank you, and take care.
Yeah, sure. I look forward to hearing about your experience when you get back.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Give us a call. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're going to do a little subject shift change and talk about mushrooms. No, not the magic kind, although I think that would also be a good topic for a program. We're going to talk about why mushrooms, how and why mushrooms should be a regular part of your diet. And I'm going to start off with a really interesting fun fact about mushrooms, which is that if you play your cards right, you can get all the vitamin D you need from mushrooms. Mushrooms are actually capable of making vitamin D when they're exposed to ultraviolet light. Not just the fancy mushrooms either. The little white mushrooms that you buy at any supermarket, particularly even the button already sliced open, the sliced ones, you can stick those out in the sun, and it will raise your vitamin D levels. It takes about a day. So if you put those mushrooms out in the morning and then eat them at the end of the day, put them in soup or whatever, it really works. So this was a study done in Germany where they had people with a baseline vitamin D level of 50, which is, I would consider, sort of the ideal vitamin D level to start with. So they weren't deficient, and that's important because you might argue that if you're deficient, you're going to absorb more of it. So they made the UVB irradiated mushrooms, putting them out in the sun, and you were getting 2,800 units of vitamin D2 from every dose of those mushrooms. And that's a high dose. I don't generally use that much in individuals that I'm supplementing, but they did it for a short period of time, so no harm done. There was a significant increase in the vitamin D in the people who were taking the soup, and it was basically about as much as people who were taking 28,000 units of vitamin D2. And that's really quite interesting that they really worked just as well. But there's a lot more to mushrooms than vitamin D. Mushrooms have a lot of compounds in them that are good for the immune system. And a diet that has a lot of mushrooms is going to do two really important things for your gut health. One of which is it's going to raise your levels of secretory IgA, which helps protect you against bacterial and viral infections of the intestinal tract. Just like the nasal mucus protects you from colds, and for that matter, COVID, the nasal mucus can protect the gut mucus, will have high levels of IgA, and it really helps. Now, I want to give you a little hint. If you are an athlete, a marathoner, someone who does competitive sports, and you push it, my advice to you is that evening, have some mushrooms, because when you eat those mushrooms, you're going to get a fairly rapid increase in your secretory IgA, and that may help to keep you from getting the post-competition cold. There was a study in Australia that showed that it increased the IgA production by 53%, and that if you took it for 1 week, that was how long they took it in the study, a week later they checked them, and they were still 50% higher, although by week three, they'd gone back to baseline. So if you eat mushrooms a couple of times a week, you're going to keep that level of helpful IgA, an antibody that is uniquely excreted in mucous membranes, and you're going to be healthier. Mushrooms also have a particular prebiotic. That's a type of fiber that we can't, a carbohydrate fiber, I should say, that we cannot digest ourselves. It's a polymer called chitin. And chitin is able to improve gut microbial diversity. So you're going to get back your recovery. And it's also associated with a reduction in inflammatory cells and decreased risk of colitis, and that's ulcerative colitis, a very bad immune disease that we'd prefer not to have. Shiitake mushrooms have broad antiviral activity, especially against influenza virus, and they seem to be able to block viral entry into the host cells, and they stimulate interferons. So all the good things that you could possibly want coming out of those shiitake mushrooms during a flu epidemic. We know that the white button mushrooms, the easy to find ones, enhance natural killer cell activity. In Japan, they're used as a treatment for cancer because they help the body's own immune response. They give you more interferon gamma and more TNF alpha. And there's some evidence, and it's, you know, a couple of studies, but still decently done, that shows that the innate immunity to tumors may be improved. There was also a study looking at beta-glycans, another compound in shiitake mushrooms, and in this study, they used lung cells and showed that the beta-glycans in mushrooms reduced the production of the inflammatory cytokines. Most of you have heard of these now. So you got interleukin-1b, you've got NF-kappa-B, interleukin-6. These are the things that go sky high in severe COVID, and you can mitigate that with the beta-glycans. So I was talking earlier about the accelerator and the brake. Well, if you need to increase your braking power during an infection, this might be also very good. Another compound that we find in mushrooms is glutathione and one called ergothioneine. These are very, very important for preventing neurodegenerative diseases. Glutathione is something I often give to my patients if I think that they have high levels of lead or mercury, or they test high for those things. Anyone with detoxification issues, I'll generally try to raise their glutathione levels. And I'm pleased to tell you that porcini and lion's mane, and I saw lion's mane for sale down at the New Leaf in Aptos just yesterday. That's a really strange looking mushroom. It sort of looks like a cauliflower, but it's very, very powerful in terms of providing glutathione. And we also get trace elements. Basically, when you're talking about mushrooms, it's better to cook them. There's a mild level of toxin in all mushrooms if they're raw. You know, just a little bit of a saute or baking them. I got this recipe. I'll share it with you. Olive oil, sea salt, minced garlic. Toss the mushrooms in there and then just put them in a pan and stick them in the oven for 20 minutes in a 370-degree oven. And that really brings them out, makes them extremely tasty. And talk about a quick and easy side dish. That's definitely going to be test kitchened sometime soon in my home. So I have to keep coming back to cholesterol and LDL because I have so many patients who come in to me and their cardiologist or their internist has told them they need to be on a statin because they have risk factors. And their risk factor, when you calculate it, is it's a guy over 70. So he's got risk factors. The way they've put this out, everybody ages in to the risk factors for coronary artery disease enough to need a statin with a normal cholesterol. I'm sorry, that's crazy, I think. And so the question is, if it's not crazy, then they should be able to produce data in older people that shows that having a high LDL is bad and causes increased mortality. So this was a population of 3,600 women who were born before 1926. Thus, there would have been women 90 years or older in the cohort. And they measured the lipids on these women when they were between 68 and 81. And if the women had existing cardiovascular disease, they were not in the study. So if you get to 68 and you haven't had a heart attack and you haven't had a stroke, you have no
existing disease. And what they found was there was no association between HDL levels, cholesterol levels, LDL cholesterols, and survival to the age of 91. So those women who had high LDL cholesterol, high, let me say that again, the top highest quartiles, 149 and above 183, those women who would be slammed onto a statin actually had higher odds of survival to the age of 90 with intact mobility compared to those women whose LDL cholesterols when they were measured were less than 126. If you're 75 or older and you have a high LDL, there's no increased risk for subsequent coronary disease. You either have it or you don't by 75. Your risk of getting it is the same or even perhaps lower than women with a quote-unquote good LDL. So what are we doing? Are we actually making people better? Or are we just lining the pockets of the pharmaceutical industry? Okay, show me your data. And if you can't come up with data that shows benefit, and in fact, you can't even show an improved lifespan, might even be lower if you take the drug, what are we doing? Well, nothing good, in my opinion. I was talking about if you're a woman over 68, there's no real clear benefit to lowering your LDL, and in fact, it might injure you. Well, these are guidelines that came out in late November 2020 from the Veterans Administration Department of Defense for their doctors. And it's really interesting because they say, you know what? We really don't care what the LDL level is. Do not treat people with statins to get a target LDL level. This is completely contrary to what they've been teaching in medical schools, I have to tell you folks, for decades and decades. And what they say is, you know, if people have a 10-year heart disease risk of greater than 12%, then put them on a moderate dose statin. If they've had a heart attack or they have risk factors like smoking, diabetes, peripheral artery disease, yeah, put them on a moderate dose statin. It isn't about the lipid level, folks. It's about the anti-inflammatory aspect that you get from a low-dose statin. It's an anti-inflammatory, and that helps reduce the event rate. They said, yeah, don't even fast the blood levels. Monitor them every 10 years. Don't check them every year. Don't do any other addition. Just put them on a moderate dose statin. And oh, by the way, tell them to eat a Mediterranean diet. And oh, by the way, put them on a structured exercise program. Encourage them to engage in regular aerobic activity. And you know what the VA's got? The VA's got a whole lot of old guys, and they do not want to pay for the bypass, and they do not want to pay for the hospitalization, because they're a national health system. And that system says, yeah, let's just put everybody on a moderate dose statin if their risk is greater than 12%. You know what? I'm not going to argue with that. If your risk is greater than 12%, you can find risk calculators, but we're not going there right now. We got another email coming in. This one is from Deborah in Chicago. Hi, Dr. Don. I listened with great interest to your recent podcast segment on hypo and hyperthyroidism. I'm 64 years old, eat a healthy diet, and exercise regularly. I was diagnosed in late January after a routine physical and subsequent blood work with Graves' disease. I was surprised with the diagnosis as I wasn't exhibiting the common symptoms. The only thing I mentioned to my doctor was that I noticed hearing my pulse in my ear and could tell my pulse was a little higher than normal. And I did lose about 5 or 6 pounds since my last physical 2 years ago, but attributed that to more exercise and watching my diet during COVID so as not to gain the COVID-19 pounds. January blood work, I won't read to you. Let's say that her thyroid stimulating hormone, the signal from the pituitary to make more thyroid, was very low. Her thyroid levels were a bit above normal, and her thyroid stimulating immunoglobulin, or thyroid stimulating antibody, which should be zero, was 18. So this says that Deborah is making antibody, and that antibody is actually acting, fooling the thyroid receptor into increasing its activity. So she is hypermetabolic because of a case of mistaken identity, or what we like to call in functional medicine, molecular mimicry. The antibody just happens to look like TSH. Wow. So the brain turns down the TSH, but it doesn't matter because it's the white blood cells that are making the antibody. So they put her on an anti-thyroid drug called metamizole. 4 weeks later, she was actually worse. The thyroid levels had come down, but the antibody levels were still high, so they increased it again, trying to get her thyroid numbers down into the normal range. We're going to talk now, drop back into her email. Previous to this year, my numbers were always in the normal range, although I have several siblings and cousins who are hypothyroid. Is there anything I should be doing from a functional medicine standpoint, or should I just expect that I may go back and forth between hyper and hypo, as you mentioned in your deep dive, until the thyroid just gives up trying to regulate itself? I'm also a regular blood donor, O negative. Well, thank you, Deborah. We all need more O negative blood out there. Is there any reason not to be donating blood at this time? I get regular emails saying they are in need of my blood type. Thank all of your listeners. Over the years, I enjoyed listening while out on the walks or working in the garden. So, Deborah, you could donate red blood cells. We wouldn't want you donating plasma because your plasma would have this thyroid-stimulating antibody in it, and that would cause the people who got the blood to become temporarily hyperthyroid. You mentioned something there about going back and forth, and that is more typical when people are going to become hypothyroid and their antibody is actually attacking the thyroid. So in your case, the antibody isn't attacking the thyroid or causing an inflammatory response. It's acting on your body tissue to cause your body tissue to think there's more thyroid hormone around than there is. So completely different target tissue. Your gland will actually be just fine. The antibody doesn't affect it directly, but your gland, of course, is where all that thyroid's coming from. So you either have to take a drug that interferes with the ability of the gland to make thyroid, or you have to damage and destroy the gland. You're not that symptomatic, and you're on the methimazole. So you can take, say, 18 months and get on a full-blown functional medicine program. And I'll tell you what that would look like. That would look like regulating your immune system, just like we've been talking about the whole show. So few short things, getting your vitamin D level up into the 70s. You're probably going to need supplementation or a lot of button mushrooms to do that. Getting your gut in order, and that's your microbiome, making sure that you don't have any, let's say, weeds in your gut garden, because those weeds stimulate the immune system and your immune system does not need to be stimulated. I'd be looking at giving you iodine, which may sound paradoxical, but actually iodine can help slow down thyroid activity, and it can, if you take larger doses of it, it might help calm down what's going on, acting almost like the methimazole. You'll need to work with a functional medicine doctor. This is not off-the-shelf kind of medicine. You're really going to need some analysis, and so I would encourage you to go to the Institute for Functional Medicine website. When you get there, I believe it's functionalmedicine.org. When you get there, put in your zip code and find yourself a certified functional medicine doctor and make an appointment, because with the appropriate guidance, you may be able to back down this autoimmune thing. It's got some sort of driver in there. It sounds like there's maybe some genetic tendency towards autoimmune, and you know, we may not be able to get you fixed, but we may be able to get you to the point where you can be balanced with just a drug and you don't need to take high levels of it and you don't need to, you know, get your thyroid destroyed with radioactive iodine, which is the typical treatment in this country and one that in Europe, they're more likely to use these anti-thyroid drugs for longer duration. But here they're very expensive. And of course, in Europe, they have national health care. So, yeah, I don't like clinical decisions being made on economic grounds. I think anyone who listens to me knows that I think there's best practice and then there's what the insurance companies let us do. And I'm not happy that that is not the same. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.